My guest on Saturday morning is clinical psychologist Dr. Olive Webb, who's nominated in the local hero category of the Kiwi Bank New Zealander of the Year Awards. A strong defender of some of the most marginalised members of our community, she tirelessly advocates and revolutionised care for people with learning disabilities. Most recently, she also gave evidence to the Royal Commission into the Abuse in State Care and supported others to tell their stories. Well, Dr. Webb released From Behind Closed Doors, her memoir last year, a poignant reflection on her 50-year journey alongside individuals with intellectual disabilities. And when Olive found out she was in for the New Zealand Local Hero Award, it came as quite the surprise.
I found out when I got a parcel in the post with the Kiwi Bank NZer of the Year medal. I had no prior warning at all.
Nothing at all. So when you opened up this, probably quite different to the normal packages that you get, you know, the bills and so on, What did you think?
Given this day and age, I first thought when I opened it, I'm being scammed. but then I opened it and this properly and this medal fell out, and I have no idea who has nominated me. And so there's this overwhelming sense of humility combined with confusion, really.
Have you been asking people? Have you tried to find out?
No, I haven't, because this is the way it's done. And I have made the assumption that the person who has nominated me either has a disability or has a family member with a disability with whom I've been involved. So I just thought it was a better option to be grateful.
A better option to be grateful. How do you look back on the career that has possibly led to someone nominating you for this?
Well, it's remarkable. I mean, when I started out 50 years ago, we were in a different time. The world was different, and our people with disabilities were people that were coped with and provided for rather than being fully accepted and integrated into the lives of us all. And the journey's not over yet, but the journey from the cramped, institutional, disgusting settings through to the lives that many people with disabilities have today, it's like going from night to day, with some notable exceptions, of course.
Absolutely. How did you first get interested in working in this area?
When I was very little, my grandmother had a friend who used to come down and help her, called Susie. And Susie had Down syndrome. Susie was completely innumerate, but she could read, and she read to us. So Susie was always in our lives. And then many years later, from high school, I went to Te Awamutu College, and a group of us set up a youth club at Tokanui Hospital for the young people who were living there. And once a year, my mother had a garden party for Tokanui residents who never went anywhere else. So we had some quite challenging people and quite challenging behaviours used to come and have a garden party on our front lawn. And I think that what it did was desensitise me to the usual sort of, or what were then common, shock horror sort of responses to people who are different.
Your mother sounds like an interesting character.
She was a force to be reckoned with.
Do you know why she had an attitude that would have been so very different to other people of her generation?
She just couldn't understand why anybody would be treated differently because they looked different or had different abilities. And she was a woman of action rather than of words. And so this is what she did.
Why do you think the attitude was that way back then? What was the underlying reason for so many people in society feeling so uncomfortable about people who had disabilities and for them to therefore end up in these institutions?
I mean, this goes back to a man who was working probably 70 or 80 years ago called Wolfensberger, and he postulated a framing, if you like, for how we treat people who are different. You know, people with intellectual disabilities, still frequently referred to as having the mind of a child. That's where the psychopedic term came from for the hospitals. And people who are different, we see this in different ethnic groups, it's a sort of a me and an otherness thing. And it's sort of a double-edged sword. One of the practices that developed in the Western world was to believe that people who are different need protection, and therefore they need to be kept away and given asylum, as it were. But of course that resulted in large institutions that nobody saw, that were secret. And so the noble aspirations somewhere in the background were lost with the economy and with the institutionalized practices that evolved.
It always feels to me like there's an element of shame here as well, though.
Possibly. When I was doing my training, I was told that lots of families and lots of parents of people with disabilities felt guilty and, you know, what had I done? I would have to say that in 50 years, I've probably met possibly one or two people who have felt guilty that there was something that they'd done during pregnancy or something like that that had caused this disability. But I think some people have been, I was going to say embarrassed, but no, that's not true. It's about otherness. It's about them. And it's about people seeing somebody who is different and then immediately assigning them to a category called them, that are differently sensitive, have different emotions, and should be grateful for what they get.
What was your route into this sector?
I'm a clinical psychologist, and I trained at Canterbury, and right from the outset, I have this interest in intellectual disability. People with intellectual disabilities are wonderful. They are so honest. They are not complicated, and they say things as they are, and it is so easy to achieve such enormous gains with people who are motivated and interested and keen and this sort of thing. So right from the outset in my internship at Sunnyside, I became involved with sections of that hospital that have people with intellectual disabilities, and I just went on from there.
What was your reaction on starting work at Sunnyside and some of the practices and the situations you were seeing?
I mean, I think the spectacle that most impressed me was going into a ward of men and seeing 20 men stripped in their dormitory, marched naked through a very large villa to the bathrooms where they were showered en masse, dried, and then marched naked back in order to get dressed with ward clothes. And this, as bad as that was, what was worse was that this was accepted practice. And so it's very difficult, when, especially when you're a young person, to know that something is wrong and then to try and find a way to do something about that.
Do you remember how you dealt with that as a, you know, as a young person right at the start of your career when you were seeing that kind of thing going on?
There's an element of self-protection. One of the things I did was make sure I never went back to that ward at that time. But that was a graphic symptom of the, I want to say, passive abuse, because people involved in this weren't trying to be abusive or anything. This was just the way it was. And so my involvement, I became the manager of three wards of people with intellectual disabilities, all adults. And I took the view that we needed to show people that these, in that instance men, but these people could actually do things and they could be productive and they could actually have a quality of life that meant that they got up in the morning to go somewhere or to do something. And they did things during the day that they enjoyed rather than just sitting, lining the walls and gazing into space.
Because it wasn't just about, for example, the way that people went to the showers. There was over-medication. There was a punitive element to this system too?
Yes, there was an expectation that they should be grateful. And certainly any break with the usual behaviour, there was certainly a punitive response. It was common to, if somebody was somehow considered to be naughty or misbehaving, for them to be required to stay in their pyjamas all day. They weren't allowed to get dressed. And that, by implication, meant that they couldn't go outside and they couldn't do things. The over-medication was a huge problem, and still is, I have to say. There are lots and lots of people with intellectual disabilities who take buckets of medication that are really for the purposes of settling their behaviour. And what this all means is that any move to individuality or to say no or I don't like that hit this response of discipline and total disempowerment.
What was your sense when you were talking with and working with some of the people within this system of how they viewed the patients?
Well, it's very difficult because I keep coming back to this. I think sociologists have this concept of otherness, you know, that they're somehow sort of not the same as us. They don't feel pain the way we feel it, and they're not entitled to all of the pleasures in life that we might expect. And in there, in the working environment, one of the first things that I did was actually find, because amongst all of this, there were other staff who were worried by what was happening, who thought there could be a better way, and were keen to respond to a little bit of leadership to start to change things.
You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National with Susie Ferguson. My guest this morning, Dr. Olive Webb, one of the nominees for the Kiwi New Zealand New Zealander of the Year Awards. Also, of course, you were the clinical psychologist. You worked at Sunnyside Hospital. You've been involved in this for years, this whole area. And when did you realise that this was a situation that had to be deinstitutionalized, that the system itself had to change?
Well, this was part of it. You know, the 1970s and 80s were actually an exciting time in disability throughout the Western world because with the leadership of people like Wolfensberger and Nerger and other people around the world, it was realised that we could humanise our services, we could individualise our services, and we could actually start to deinstitutionalise and treat people who have an intellectual disability simply as people with whims and wants and likes and challenges, and to treat them one by one instead of this one-size-fits-all solution for, I don't know, bunching them all together and providing cheap and efficient care. And so in New Zealand throughout this time, it was actually really exciting. I mean, at one stage towards the, I think it would have been mid-90s or something, there were people with disabilities who marched on Parliament demanding the closure of Kimberley Hospital. And I mean, I don't think there's any sector that is that mobilised now. And so it was an exciting time, and there were experiences to share and challenges to rise to. And so it became a process of finding cohorts of managers and cohorts of nurses and support people who wanted to be part of this. And it was a time when it was great to get up in the morning and go to work.
And you sort of started small in giving people a purpose and in beginning to take those first steps to change.
Yes, in that first same disgusting ward, we established, I had a wonderful occupational therapist, Margaret Miller, working with us, and we established a tiny little work group of, I think there were six people, and we gave them a very simple task to do, and they were actually putting sticky labels on bibs that were then used in the geriatric wards. You know, it gets worse. And at the end of each day, they worked for 45 minutes, and at the end of that day we paid them, actually with wooden tokens, which they then went and we got the senior nurses to open up a shop that we had stocked in the ward office. And so these six people got things that no one else in the ward could have. And within 2 weeks, we had a second group that had come in and formed themselves of about 15 guys who were doing the same task and initially not getting paid for it at all. And it just took off, and people started to look around, and they started to look at each other, and they started to talk. And there was this sort of, I don't know, it's like a mobilization of spirits, you know. And at that particular point, that ward closed, and we went to another ward, and so a new building, and so introduced these programs as just, this is what happens in this place. And it was fantastic. What happened quickly after that is one of the other villas bailed me up, very angry, because the first ward was getting all of the treatment and all of the attention, and why couldn't they do that too? So very quickly we fell into capturing those people who were mobilised to work the change, and to, if you like, capturing those residents who wanted to do something, and it just became infectious.
And so as this change is beginning to snowball, was there anyone pushing back against this?
Absolutely. And this is, I mean, this was when we started to actually move people out of the hospital, because there was quite a gap between those very first initiatives and actually moving people out. We could have had a huge amount of ground to recover. And what we did, quite manipulatively really, was the most difficult people in the hospital, we placed them out in the community homes. And they then had positions of good status, good standing, and became quite proprietorial over the community homes that they were running, and it was fantastic.
Did you yourself receive threats for making and instigating this change?
Yes, I had some senior governance people, because I was seconded. Not only was I doing this at Sunnyside in my own area of the hospital, but I was also seconded to the then Department of Health to lead the de-inst movement, and to, you know, we developed a roadshow and we went around the hospitals and we spoke to parent groups and we did all of those sorts of things. And at that level, I did have one person write to George Salmon, who was then the Director General of Health, asking if my employment should be reviewed, given that what I was doing was essentially in opposition to these institutions. And George Salmon wrote back to this person, copied it to me, which is unheard of, and said it's not what Dr. Webb is saying that is problematical, but whether or not it's true. And we just carried on.
What was it like to know that there were people who were opposed to you trying to change the lives of the people within the institutions?
I mean, it was actually huge. Some of the parents' associations at the time were very, very politically able, very capable, intelligent people, and they just hated the notion of closing the institutions, because there was this belief that had been promulgated that if the institutions were closed, then their children would have to go back home and live with them. And, of course, that was never the intention. There were a number of parents, and in the context of my book, I inserted some of the letters to the editor, and they were simply nasty. I don't think I got personal sort of physical threats, but there was this huge attempt to erode any credibility that I might have.
And I mean, that in itself can be upsetting, it can be off-putting. I suppose you can also harness that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you were looking at an overall culture change, about bringing about that sort of revolution, really. Because this wasn't about picking off one or two bad apples of people who were working within the institution. This was about the institution itself.
You're quite correct. And I think that what happened, as I say, there was this cohort of managers and cohorts of staff, and we were sort of mutually encouraging each other and providing that sort of support. And you see, at the same time, I mean, in order to achieve all this, we broke every rule in the book. We double dipped, and we set up community homes but staffed them with nurses. And that was considered to be, and we also staffed them with nurses working the so-called fours and two shifts, which is a very strange way to staff a home. But
what's the fours and twos shift?
That nurses work then four on and two off. Mm. So in a community home, that's a bit odd, because it takes a number of staff to work a full roster. Mm. And that meant that there were a lot of people going through the lives of the residents of any one home. And that in itself is confusing and can become overwhelming at times. But we figured it could be decades before the nursing rosters were changed, and we weren't prepared to wait.
I guess, looking at the situation from, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you've been able to help people give evidence and to tell their story to the Royal Commission into Abuse in State Care. It's something that you've also given your story to. Mm. What hopes do you have for that inquiry?
We all have hopes that we can do this, but those hopes for me are tempered with the reality that there are always people who resent expenditure on people with disabilities. In the course of the deinstitutionalisation of Sunnyside, somebody said to me, after we opened a new community home for six very disabled people, why would we go spend that much money on people like that? Couldn't you do it cheaper? And I remember a conversation that I had with a senior official once who said, why do we have trouble with these difficult children? Can't we just get a home and bung six of them in together and staff it? And it is this pull towards what might be termed pragmatism, but pull towards efficiency, and a sense that people with disabilities are not worth the money and the resources that it takes for them to have the same quality of life that you and I have. Mm. And that's a tension that I don't see going away.
It's pretty profoundly upsetting to come up against that kind of attitude still, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot of it about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. Because why? Because efficiency is more important than humanity?
I think to some people that's true. Absolutely. But this is compounded now by, you know, in Christchurch, if you have a child who requires assessment in the paediatric unit, which does wonderful work, you're likely to wait 18 months to 2 years before that child can be assessed. And if you are an adult with autism or want an assessment for autism or ADHD, those assessment services are not provided by the public service. And so there is, you know, it's not just that we want to be efficient with what we've got, but there is also a resistance to providing the full breadth of services that people with disabilities need.
Is it clear to you why that is still the case?
I think the standard argument is it's about priorities. Mm. And if you're not far up the totem pole, then you're not a priority.
If you could redesign the system, what would you do?
Start at the bottom. Start at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And find out what it is that individuals, not groups, but what individuals need in order to have, and there's a standard, long-standing government document called An Ordinary Life, which has been reasonably ignored for a lot of years. And you know, not have to qualify for a service. You know, I've been asked to assess a 66-year-old woman who has an intellectual disability who is still living with her mother. And the state won't pay for her care until she has a formal diagnosis of intellectual disability provided by a psychologist, which, of course, the public system doesn't provide. Mm. You know, when I ran a dual diagnosis service out of Sunnyside as we were deinstitutionalising, and the criterion, there was one criterion for getting a service provided from there, and that was that somebody asked for help. And right now, it's almost a slogan, I've got a service and I bet you can't get into it. And because there are all of these barriers and checkboxes and things that have to be processed before you can get through to a proper service delivery point.
Perhaps it's an attitude that has become less obvious, I guess, since you first encountered it, or perhaps it is that people have become more informed or more open-minded in connection with people who have disabilities. Nonetheless, though, what do you see as being the impact with this attitude on, I suppose, the other end of things, before the people are here, when you have a pregnancy and have the scan that determines your possible outcome, for example, of the child having Down syndrome, and some of the recommendations that are potentially made on abortion around that. Is that comfortable to you?
No, it's very, very difficult. I was reading something, I think, yesterday. The people with Down syndrome say, and this has been promulgated through People First, that if having Down syndrome is grounds for abortion, then what does that say to the value that you're going to place on a person who has Down syndrome? And it's a very difficult ethical question.
And as science and medicine probably inevitably become more sophisticated and more discoveries are made, you know, you can't tell someone who's pregnant that their child has autism, for example. There isn't a scan or a test.
But not only that, but autism isn't a bad thing.
Mm.
You know, we would be, where would we be with our surgeons and many of our engineers if we didn't have a bit of autism floating around?
Indeed. But I suppose the point being that if there are certain conditions that now we don't know until they show up, but if it's possible in the future to find things out, where's the line? What's acceptable? What's reasonable?
Yeah, that's the question. And I think that the better approach to the question is to say, okay, if somebody who has some individual traits, some characteristics, some special sorts of needs or some very different needs, what we need to be able to do is to respond to that person immediately and as they grow. Because that person who is born with whatever challenge they might have has the same citizenship as you and I, and so is as entitled to all of the supports that you and I have. And what we have to do is not discriminate against people because they haven't yet, the checkbox hasn't been ticked yet. I mean, a case in point is fetal alcohol syndrome. And even after the disaster of Tina Pora, we still don't have a funding stream to support young people coming on, and there's a lot of them, who have fetal alcohol syndrome. And it's crazy because we should be able to say that if somebody has a particular need that is may well be lifelong, may be disabling, or may be disabling for a while, they've got to get into an approved funding pathway before they can get the support that they should be entitled to as citizens of this country.
And that is Olive Webb, Dr. Olive Webb, who is nominated in the local hero category of the Kiwi Bank New Zealander of the Year Awards. Her memoir, From Behind Closed Doors, was released last year, a reflection on her 50-year career alongside individuals with intellectual disabilities.